My name is Michael McCusker. Today is going to be a bit of a potpourri, sort of cleaning out the closet in a sense. Things I haven't read that I would like to read. So I'd like to read a couple of things. The first actually appeared in the November 19th, 2009 issue of the New York Review of Books. Friends of mine, when they finish the pulp that they subscribe to, leave piles of it on my porch so that I have a chance to read it, and then I recycle it. And recently I received about a year and a half's worth of review of books, New York Review of Books, and kept those that I hadn't read before, and this is one of them. And it's called The Tragedy of Leonard Peltier versus the United States by Peter Matteson. And we haven't heard much of Peltier lately. He's once again disappeared into the fog of noise, I suppose, our media could be called. So I'm going to read it. And Peter Matteson is maybe a few of you might know, has written and traveled all over the world, and he writes about almost everything you can think about, including travel. And as of this account, he won the 2008 National Book Award for his novel, Shadow Country, and his more recent books, at least according to 2009, include End of Earth, Voyage to Antarctica, and The Birds of Heaven, Travels with Cranes, which probably shows you some of his range. This is another part of it. The Tragedy of Leonard Peltier versus the U.S. by Peter Matteson. On July 27, 2009, I drove west from New York to the old riverside town of Lewisburg in central Pennsylvania, the site of the federal penitentiary where early the next morning I would make an appeal to the parole board on behalf of the American Indian Movement, AIM, activist Leonard Peltier in his first parole hearing in 15 years. On this soft summer evening, a quiet gathering of Peltier supporters from all over the country had convened in a small park near the Susquehanna River. Despite his long history of defeats in court, these Indians and whites, sharing a makeshift picnic wood tables under the trees, were optimistic about a favorable outcome. Surely a new era of justice for minorities and poor people had begun with the Obama administration. And anyway, wasn't Leonard's freedom all but assured by the Parole Act of 2005, which mandated release for inmates who had spent 30 or more years in prison? Leonard Peltier, an Ojibwa Lakota from Turtle Mountain, North Dakota, was one of the three young Indians who were among the participants in a shootout with the FBI at Oglala on South Dakota's Pine Ridge Reservation on a hot, dusty day in June 1975. They were later charged with the deaths of FBI agents Jack Kohler and Ron Williams. Ostensibly searching for a suspect in a recent robbery case, the agents had been warned by tribal police not to enter the property where the AIM Indians had their camp. Their intrusion apparently provoked a warning that led to an exchange of gunfire. Understandably outraged by the deaths of Kohler and Williams, and in particular by the fact that an unknown shooter, and that's in quotes, had finished off both wounded men at point-blank range, their fellow agents would also suffer intense frustration and embarrassment when a dozen or more of the Indians involved, using a brushy culvert under a side road, escaped a tight cordon of hundreds of agents, Indian and state police, National Guardsmen, and vigilantes who had the area surrounded. More galling still, Bob Robideau and Dino Butler, two of the three AIM suspects in the killings arrested during the FBI's huge Res Moors, and that's in quotes, in parentheses, reservation murders, investigation, were acquitted a year later in Cedar Rapids, Iowa, on a plea of self-defense, as the third and last suspect, Leonard Peltier, would certainly have been as well had he not fled to Canada. He was arrested there in February 1976, extradited back to the U.S., and tried separately. Though originally indicted with the others on identical evidence, he was barred by a hostile new judge, Paul Benson, from presenting the same argument based on self-defense that had led to Robideau and Butler's acquittal. Furiously prosecuted as the lone killer and convicted for both deaths on disputed evidence, Peltier was sentenced in February 1977 in Fargo, North Dakota, to two consecutive life terms in federal prison. The following year, when Peltier's conviction was appealed, Eighth Circuit Court of Appeals Judge Donald Ross denounced the coercion of witnesses and manipulation of evidence in his case as a clear abuse of the investigative process by the FBI. The U.S. Attorney's Office also would be sharply criticized for withholding exculpatory evidence. In October 1984, in an evidentiary hearing in Bismarck, North Dakota, ordered by the appellate court to review the possibility of a new trial, the prosecutor, U.S. Attorney Lynn Crooks, a good name for a prosecutor, had to conclude that the FBI's own laboratory had failed to verify the claimed ballistic link between Peltier and the murder weapon that was used to nail down his conviction, a shell casing of disputed provenance that Crooks had called, quote, perhaps the most important piece of evidence in this case, unquote. Even so, Judge Benson refused to reconsider the conviction. The following year, when the decision was appealed again, Crooks finally admitted that the identity of the shooter, again in quotes, had never been proven and was in fact unknown to the prosecution, even when it was twisting the evidence to ensure Peltier's conviction and make certain that its third and last suspect, by its own description, the only one we got, in quotes, was imprisoned for life. Yet the appellate court, while noting that so much tainted evidence had deprived the defendant of his constitutional right to due process of law, found, quote, no compelling legal justification, unquote, for ordering a new trial. In a television interview after his retirement in 1989, Judge Gerald Heaney, who had signed that astonishing decision, called it the most difficult I had to make in 22 years on the bench. The following year, in the National Law Journal, this troubled jurist held the FBI equally responsible for the deaths of its two agents. In a letter to Senator Daniel Inouye of Hawaii, he urged commutation of Peltier's sentence. Questioned on the same 1989 television show about the perjured affidavits extracted by FBI agents from a frightened alcoholic, U.S. Attorney Crooks declared, I don't really know and I don't really care if they were false. I don't agree that we did anything wrong, but I can tell you it did not bother my conscience one whit if we did. Properly outraged by this arrogant refusal to repudiate U.S. government use of fabricated evidence, Senator Inouye, as a former U.S. attorney, called Crooks a disgrace to the profession. I first interviewed Leonard Peltier in Marion Penitentiary in 1981, and that same year, with his original co-defendant Bob Robideau, I inspected the Jumping Bowl Ranch at Oglala, where the shootout had taken place. Later, after reading many, if not most, of the pertinent documents, including the FBI field reports and the transcripts of both trials, I returned to Oglala to interview local people and study the scene again. Like the FBI, I would hear all sorts of rumors about the many young Indians involved without learning which one had fired the fatal shots. However, there seemed to me no doubt whatever that Leonard Peltier had been railroaded into prison. Unfortunately, a book I wrote making that case, in the spirit of Crazy Horse, was quickly suppressed by libel suits brought by South Dakota's Attorney General, William Janklow, and an FBI agent named David Price. 8 years would pass before both suits were summarily dismissed and the book was back in circulation. Meanwhile, Peltier's long fight for fair trial had won his endorsement as a political prisoner by Amnesty International, and his thousands of supporters throughout the world included the Dalai Lama, Nelson Mandela, Desmond Tutu, and the great majority of his own people in the more than 250 Indian nations that had formally demanded his release. In Peltier's first parole hearing in 1996, the examiner filed an internal recommendation in Peltier's favor. The U.S. Parole Commission, like the U.S. Attorney's Office and the FBI, is under the aegis of the Justice Department. Its examiner informs himself about the case, questions both sides, and appraises the new evidence, if any. Yet, in actions so belated and irregular as to raise suspicion of undue influence, the commission replaced that first examiner with one more to its liking and denied parole. By then, the few bold lawmakers who had called for investigations had retreated or retired, and Peltier's best hope was executive clemency. To that end, I wangled my way into the Oval Office and pressed my book about the case into President Clinton's hands. In January 2001, during Clinton's last week in office, as FBI lobbyists, the Association of Retired FBI Agents, and No Parole for Peltier, marched in front of the White House, I joined attorney Bruce Ellison and filmmaker John Kielik in a long meeting with the presidential and White House counsels in which we argued that granting clemency to an American Indian who could offer nothing in return was a bold symbolic step that could only enhance the president's last-minute efforts to prop up his legacy. The lawyers seemed impressed and hopes were high, but when the clemency list appeared on the Saturday morning of Inauguration Day, Peltier's name was missing. The phone call I dreaded was put through from Leavenworth Prison in early afternoon. "They didn't give it to me," mumbled a stunned voice I scarcely recognized. The first time in 20 years of visits, letters, and telephone conversations that Leonard Peltier's strong spirit sounded broken. With all court appeals exhausted and no hope of mercy from the incoming Republican administration, George Bush, if you remember, this aging prisoner was condemned to wait for his next parole hearing in 2009. In the park in Lewisburg, people agreed that the shootout victims had not been FBIs. Leonard might never have been convicted. At the very least, he would have been paroled many years before. Someone in the park recalled the fear and disruption on the reservations caused by the FBI's huge reservation murders investigation, which was widely perceived as the latest chapter in the long history of oppression and revenge against, quote, the Redskins who killed Custer, unquote, that had led up to the shootout. The killing that day in June 1975 of a young member of the AIM by a marksman's bullet in the forehead had gone all but unmentioned, someone said, let alone investigated by the Injustice Department, and that's a quote, doubtless because, another quote, Indians don't count. How about Bob Robideau's statement to an FBI man that he had been the shooter? Would the parole commission take that into account? And was it suspicious that Robideau had been found dead last February in Barcelona? And that would be 2008. Or perhaps actually 2009. The official autopsy concluded that he had struck his head in a fall while suffering a seizure. With Peltier's attorney, Eric Seitz, and the two other parole advocates, Dr. Tom White, Wolf Fassett, a Seneca elder, and United Methodist advisor to Congress on Indian Affairs, and an Ojibwa woman named Cindy Maltier, representing Peltier's Turtle Mountain Reservation, I went early the next morning to the prison, passing supporters waving Free Peltier signs at the entrance road. In the hearing room, the first to speak were the two sons of the late agent Jack Kohler. After testifying to their family's great loss, they suggested that if this man facing them today were to take responsibility and express remorse for those brutal murders he so stubbornly denies having committed, the Kohler family might not protest his parole. But the three FBI spokesmen and the assistant U.S. attorney who spoke next were content to repeat the same vilifications and distortions of the facts that won a conviction back in 1977. Locked long ago into their Res Moores myth, reservation murders, they insisted that Peltier was still a danger to the public and cited those provisions in the Parole Act specifying that parole may be denied if the subject's release might, quote, depreciate the seriousness of the offense, unquote, or, again a quote, promote disrespect for the law. In response to the charge that Peltier has evaded his responsibility for those murders, Eric Seitz countered that the FBI and the U.S. Attorney's Office have evaded responsibility for their own illegal tactics in his prosecution. Otherwise, Seitz made no attempt to retry a long historic case in a few minutes, emphasizing instead the prisoner's exemplary behavior record, serious health problems, and other strong qualifications for parole under the Commission's geriatric and medical criteria. He reminded examiner Scott Kubik that in a few weeks, on September 12th, when Peltier would turn 65, he would also become eligible for home detention under the new Second Chance program for elderly inmates designed to ease overcrowding in the U.S. prisons. Tom White, and that's T-H-O-M, Tom Whitewolf, testified that Peltier's incarceration for nearly 33 years, now it is 35, has been viewed both nationally and internationally as a gross injustice and a major embarrassment to our country, with a negative effect on the world's view of how the U.S. government treats its native population. When my turn came, I spoke to the points made in this article, adding how much this inmate had matured over the three decades of our acquaintance, not only as an articulate spokesman for his people, but as an artist, self-taught in the prisons, whose work is admired throughout the U.S. And Cindy Maltier assured the examiner that the prisoners, Ojibwa Dakota people at Turtle Mountain, including grandchildren he has never seen, had already taken care of the parole requirements of social support, adequate housing, and steady employment as an arts and crafts teacher and alcoholism counselor on the reservation, and were planning to welcome him home with a great feast. That afternoon, we left the prison with the feeling that Examiner Kubik had listened carefully and would recommend parole, a guarded optimism we conveyed to the flag-waving supporters awaiting our report on the public road. But no one forgot how the examiner's finding in Peltier's favor 15 years before had been aborted. In the next weeks, as so often in the past, the prisoner would have to suffer the suspense of desperate hope. On Friday, August 20th, 2009, federal inmate number 89637-132 received terse notice that his petition for parole had been denied. Not until his 15-year reconsideration hearing in July 2024, and that's a quote, he was informed, would he become eligible to be turned down again. In the unlikely event that he lives long enough to attend that hearing, inmate Peltier will be 80 years old. In his angry response, Attorney Seitz accused the commission of adopting the position of the FBI that anyone who may be implicated in the killings of its agents should never be paroled and should be left to die in prison. And that's a quote. I entirely agree with Seitz and share his anger. For the prisoner and his supporters, the Lewisburg hearing had been hollow, with a predetermined outcome. The United States versus Leonard Peltier had always been a matter less of justice than of retribution. Americans, those in public office especially, should inform themselves about this painful case and demand an unbiased investigation that might start with one simple question. If in the 33 years, and now 35, since his trial, reputable evidence has never emerged that Leonard Peltier was the lone killer and deserves to be imprisoned for life, why hasn't the Justice Department produced it? Without public protest, Peltier will not be granted a fair hearing since his prosecutors know that in the absence of honest evidence, quote, the only one we got, unquote, would be set free. Instead, this man's life leaks away behind grim concrete walls for the unworthy purpose of saving face for the FBI and a U.S. Attorney's Office that together botched the famous Resmores, Reservation Murders, case and mean to see somebody pay. And who better for his fate than a radical, and that's a quote, AIM Indian, who dared stand up to, quote, legally constituted authority, unquote, in defense of his humiliated people, as he was doing with such tragic consequences on that long ago June day. In reviewing this case with an open mind, as surely he must in fulfilling his oath of office, Attorney General Eric Holder, the Assistant Attorney General in 2001, might reflect on his own role in the clemency bestowed by Clinton on Mark Rich, the notorious fugitive felon. And that's a quote. He might consider, too, Rich's consequent evasion of even a single day in prison in the harsh light of the 11,000 days already served by a penniless American Indian who remains innocent before the law, having never been proven guilty. And you can add another 2 years to those 3,000 days. And that was by Peter Matteson, The Tragedy of Leonard Peltier versus the U.S. And Peltier's book, published by Viking in 1983, is called In the Spirit of Crazy Horse, in case anyone's interested in picking up a copy of it. It might still be in print. All right. And now I'd like to read an opinion in the New York Times of Sunday, August 7th, 2011. The Arms Race That Intrudes on Paradise by Gloria Steinem. Or Steinem, I beg your pardon. I always pronounce that wrong. And, of course, she's the founder of Ms. and co-founder of the Women's Media Center. There are some actions for which those of us alive today will be judged in centuries to come. The only question will be, what did we know and when did we know it? I think one judgment-worthy action may be what you and I do about the militarization of Jeju Island, South Korea, in service of the arms race. Jeju isn't called the most beautiful place on Earth for nothing. Ancient volcanoes have become snow-covered peaks with pure mountain streams running down to volcanic beaches and reefs of soft coral. In between are green hills covered with wildflowers, mandarin orange groves, nutmeg forests, tea plantations, and rare orchids growing wild, all existing at peace with farms, resorts, and small cities. UNESCO, the United Nations Educational, Scientific, and Cultural Organization, has designated Jeju Island a World Natural Heritage Site. Now a naval base is about to destroy a crucial stretch of the coast of Jeju, and will do this to dock and service destroyers with sophisticated ballistic missile defense systems and space war applications. China and South Korea have positive relations at the moment, but this naval base is not only an environmental disaster on an island less than two-thirds the size of Rhode Island, it may be a globally dangerous provocation besides. Residents of Gongjeon, the village that is to be home to this base, and I hope I pronounced it correctly, have been living in tents along the endangered coastline trying to stave off the dredging and bulldozing. In a vote several years ago at a village meeting, residents overwhelmingly opposed the base. They've tried to block construction with lawsuits and pleas for a proper environmental impact study. They've been fined, beaten, arrested, and imprisoned. They've gone on hunger strikes, chained themselves to anything available, invited tourists in to see what's at stake, established websites and won support from global peace organizations. Members of the No Base, and that's a quote, campaign, including children, camp out along the shore behind high walls erected around the site to conceal the protests. Police officers patrol outside. This has been going on for more than 4 years. You may be wondering why you haven't heard more about it. I doubt that I would know either if I hadn't visited Jeju Island 9 years ago and been unable to shake the memory of its beauty and traditions that may be remnants of an ancient culture of balance. The island itself is said to be the body of the creation goddess and is often called Woman's Island. It is home to the legendary women deep sea divers known as Hanyo, as well as for sacred goddess groves and shamanistic traditions. For many women especially, it is becoming a symbol of what once was and could be. But among the half million or so residents, there are also memories of terrible loss. Before and during World War II, Japanese troops stationed there used islanders as forced labor and murdered many. Just before the Korean War, South Korean forces burned villages to the ground and killed perhaps as many as 30,000 islanders because they did not support dividing the peninsula into North and South, and so were assumed to be communists. But with work and old wisdom, Jeju gradually restored its uniquely peaceful culture as South Korea's only autonomous province. In 2006, Roh Moo-hyun, then South Korea's president, apologized for the massacre and declared Jeju the island of global peace. When I was invited in May to again visit Jeju by friends in the Korean women's movement, I could see why it attracts peace conferences, honeymooners, environmentalists, marine biologists, film crews, pilgrims, and tourists. But I also visited the peace encampment within sight of harassing police officers and waiting bulldozers. The mayor of the village, the leader of the resistors, said quietly that he and others would give their lives to stop construction. His 92-year-old mother walks down from the village to the shore every morning to make sure he is still alive. Still, the South Korean president, Lee Myung-bak, a former head of a construction company who was known as Mr. Bulldozer, hasn't yet had a change of heart about supporting the naval base. Indeed, he seems to have the same relationship to construction that President George W. Bush had to oil. But I fear South Korea is a tail being wagged by the Pentagon dog. In contrast, his predecessor, Mr. Roh, said before he died that he regretted only two things, sending South Korean troops to Iraq and permitting a naval base on Jeju Island. Jeju Island is on a very short list of candidates in a public internet campaign to choose a new Seven Wonders of the World, and Mr. Lee is campaigning hard for it. He may have to choose. How can Jeju Island be one of the Seven Wonders when its claim rests on nature about to be destroyed? Meanwhile, there are more people signing protest petitions on the web, calling anyone they know in Washington or going on Jeju Island to support and safeguard the protesters and show that tourists without guns, not military bases, are its economic future. In my daily emails with protesters on Jeju, I learned that bulldozers were spreading small rocks in preparation for laying concrete over lava and living coral that is a distinctive natural habitat. Once the bulldozers are out of sight, children pick up those rocks, pile them into towers, and plant a peace flag in each one. For myself, I am writing this column, putting a petition on my Facebook page, and hoping for enough Arab Spring-like activism to topple one naval base. I have never known less what will happen. I can still hear the dolphins crying as if sensing danger. But somehow my faith is in the villagers who say, "Touch not one stone, not one flower." Besides, now you know. And that was The Arms Race Intrudes on Paradise by Gloria Steinem. You've been listening to A Story Told. I'm Michael McCusker.